Chapter 12 The Hawthorne Studies and Related Ideas. Hawthorne Studies. Note this paper, Chapter 12, was originally submitted for a course on organizational behavior, but it is included here, in a slightly modified form, because it fits in well with the theme of this book. What we can learn from the Hawthorne Studies. The Hawthorne Studies is an important scientific investigation for organizational behavior and the practice of management. These studies were conducted from 1924 to 1933 at the Western Electric Company located in Hawthorne, Illinois, which employed approximately 29,000 workers. This company assembled telephone-related equipment for the Bell system, and was interested in determining if additional lighting could result in an increase in productivity. The studies were carried out initially by the company's engineers. The results they obtained were confusing and ambiguous. Harvard professors Elton Mayo, Fritz Rothlisberger and William Dixon were called in to try to resolve the confusing puzzle. In an effort to solve the ambiguous puzzle, much was learned about human behavior in the workplace, which had a major impact on the philosophy and practice of management from the 30s and beyond. By examining the Hawthorne studies, as will be done in this paper, it is still possible to learn many interesting ideas and principles from this research. The Hawthorne studies were not planned to be a major long-term investigation of human behavior in organizations. The original purpose of the study was only to test the benefits of additional lighting in the workplace, and nothing more. Specifically, the goal was to determine the optimum level of lighting and to prove that additional lighting can increase productivity. This first part of the Hawthorne studies began in 1924 and involved the following. The level of illumination was increased in three sections of the plant. The results that were obtained were confusing and mysterious. The productivity of one department varied erratically, and productivity in the other two increased, but, again, erratically, so that the researchers were not sure of the true cause of the change. This was a quote, Pepper, Gerald, L., 1995, pages 86. The researchers carried out the illumination experiments again, with a more precise set of controlled conditions. This involved two groups of similar workers that were doing identical tasks. One of these groups was used as a control group, which meant no change in the illumination was made in their work environment. The other group, the experimental group, worked under various lighting conditions. The obvious assumption would be that the control group would not change its productivity, and the experimental group's productivity should vary with the lighting conditions. If the lighting was low, productivity should drop. If the lighting was normal, productivity should stay the same. If the lighting was increased to optimum levels, productivity should increase. However, a very confusing result was obtained. The productivity in the control group and the experimental group increased to about the same level. Needless to say, this was surprising and confusing to the researchers. The researchers thought that maybe the confusing results were caused by a mixture of artificial and natural illumination. They decided to test the above theory by eliminating the natural light sources. That is, the experiment was repeated with only artificial lighting, which was at a lower illumination level than the lighting of the previous experiment. The results were even more puzzling and confusing than before. Productivity increased again in both the control and experimental groups. There were some decreases in productivity only when the lighting was reduced to the level of bright moonlight. Thus, the confusing results of the experiment did not seem to make any sense. The workers produced more under all three conditions, which was increased lighting, decreased lighting, and no change in lighting. The only reduction in productivity was when the lighting was reduced to an extremely low level. Apparently, the results were caused by something other than lighting. Thus, there was a real mystery here. At this point, the Harvard professors Elton Mayo, Fritz Rothlisberger and William Dixon were called in to try to solve this strange mystery. From this point on, the Hawthorne studies no longer focused on the illumination problem. The goal was, at this point, to figure out the nature of the mystery. The researchers initially believed that the mysterious experimental results related to relative degrees of fatigue in some way. In their effort to solve the mystery, the Harvard professors tried to work out their experiments very carefully. They took six women telephone relay assemblers from the regular work group. Before this was done, the women were informed of the nature of the experiment and told not to perform any differently than they would normally. This was a quote, Pepper, Gerald, L., 1995, pages 86. See the note marked with it at the end of this paragraph. The women's work output was measured, without any experimental manipulation, in the new group environment for a period of 5 weeks. The work these women did was not paced by any machine mechanism, such as a moving assembly line, which made their work useful for experimental purposes. It was also relatively easy to measure their individual work output, because of the nature of the assembly work that they did. The work output of each woman was recorded in their original work group for a period of 2 weeks, before they were separated into separate groups for experimental observation. The experimental observations were focused on fatigue and how it affected productivity. Various factors were manipulated, such as giving longer rest breaks, giving shorter rest breaks, offering snacks, not offering snacks, shortening the workday, lengthening the workday, etc. The results were essentially similar to the illumination experiments, a mystery. That is, no matter what experimental variable was manipulated, the productivity tended to increase. This increase was even present when there was no experimental manipulation. Note, incidentally, informing the women that their work was going to be studied is a major oversight. This awareness can invalidate any results that can be obtained, under many conditions. The ideal way to perform such studies, whether it involves illumination, fatigue in the work environment, new equipment, new production procedures, or whatever, is not to inform the workers that they are being studied, and not to remove them from their regular work groups. However, the 5-week adjustment period and evaluations without experimental manipulations that the Hawthorne researchers provided would partly compensate for the fact that experimental and control subjects were in a different group than previously. Perhaps some would argue that not informing the workers that they were going to be studied would be unethical, but if their identities were kept anonymous, the ethical issue should be considered resolved. End of note. Another experiment that was carried out involved a group of 5 women. Rest pauses and the length of the workday were experimentally manipulated. The results of this study were not totally consistent with other studies in the series, but they were mysterious nevertheless. Productivity increased only to a point, and leveled off. Variations in the activity of the women were noted. A primary difference between this group and the other experimental groups were the workers never formed close personal ties with each other. However, just like the other experiments, the overall results were puzzling and confusing. The researchers also tried manipulating wages in terms of bonuses paid for doing a certain quantity of work. These bonuses did not appear to have much of an effect on the productivity of the workers. Thus, the Harvard researchers, to this point, increased the mystery. However, they were able to unravel the mysterious results by changing their research strategy. They stopped experimenting and started communicating with the workers. They conducted 10,000 interviews, resulting in over 86,000 comments on 80 interview topics. This was a quote, Pepper, G. L., 1995, pages 88. In the beginning, the interviews were carried on for about 30 minutes each, but as the research progressed, the sessions were lengthened to 160 to 90 minutes. To check and reinforce the information obtained by the interviews, the Hawthorne researchers also decided to watch and listen to the workers performing their jobs. The interviews and the observations revealed that the work groups had certain group norms that controlled productivity. There was a concept of what constituted a day's work. If an individual exceeded what was considered a day's work, he or she was in effect punished by the group. The level of conformity to these norms determined the degree that the individual was accepted socially by the group. In the following paragraphs, there are some actual comments taken from the original interviews and observations, which reveal the above in detail. The words that are in bold type and underlined are the original comments of the workers and the individuals involved in collecting the information. The comments from the interviews and the observations were taken from F.J. Roethlisberger, William J. Dixon, Management and the Worker, copyright 1939 and 1967, pages 413 to 423. Note that these two authors were the original Harvard researchers involved with the Hawthorne studies. Each of the original statements is followed by one or more paragraphs of my interpretation and related information that can be derived from the statements. The Hawthorne workers had their own jargon. However, as you read through the text, their terminology and feelings becomes understandable. I provided some brief statements to clarify their jargon when it appeared necessary. The above authors used the following designation to designate the job title of the people. W equals wireman, S equals solderman, GC equals group chief. Int. Equals interviewer, obs. Equals observer. A number with a subscript was added by the authors to designate the individuals involved. W16600 is the bogey. Yes, see, that's two sets. There are 3,300 connections on a set. Now on selector wiring, the bogey is only 6,000, because there are only 3,000 connections on a set. In order to turn out 6,600 there, you have to wire 3 levels on a third set. This was a quote in 6,600 is your bogey then? W1 yes, it's 6,600. Yes, see, they told us if we got out 2 sets a day it would be alright. That's a pretty good day's work too. Actually, this worker, just like most of the other workers interviewed, defined a day's work as wiring up two electronic devices. This definition of a day's work was the same, even if the electronic device had 3,300 or only 3,000 connections. The bogey was the goal set by the company, and it was actually 7,312 connections a day. Few workers would reach such a goal. As will be seen later, there were strong group norms against exceeding the workers' definition of a day's work, which was the wiring of only two electronic devices. W2, you know, some of those fellows stall around for 3 months before they turn out 6,000. There's no reason for that at all. I could turn out 6,000 in 3 weeks. I think the rest of them could if they wanted to. I'm making around 7,000 every day. I don't mind that they're fooling around as long as it doesn't interfere with the work. I never fool around until I have my bogey out. That is the first thing. When I get my bogey out, then I don't mind loafing around a bit. This was a quote. This worker believes that the other workers could learn to be more productive if they wanted to. He points out that many of the workers are employed for 3 months before they turn out 6,000 connections a day, suggesting that they can do much better. This worker W2 defined a day's work for himself as 7,000 connections. This is a violation of the informal norms of the group. Some of the fooling around that he talks about, in relation to the behavior of his fellow workers, is probably teasing with some real hostile intentions focused on him, because of the violation of the informal group norms. W3, I turn out 6,600 regularly. That's about what is expected of us. Of course you could make out less and get by, but it's safer to turn out about 6,600. This was a quote in and is 6,600 your bogey? This was a quote W3, no, our bogey is higher than that. It is 914 an hour. This was a quote. This worker follows the group norms of 6,600, which is the wiring of two electronic devices. He did not answer the interviewer's question or did not understand the question when the interviewer asked him, is 6,600 your bogey? This was a quote. This means, what is your goal for the typical workday as far as production is concerned? His reply of 914 an hour is the idealized goal set by the company. W4, this was a quote. I think connector wiring is the better job. The boards aren't as heavy as on selectors and you have an extra bank. You see, the rate on connectors is around 6,600 and on selectors it's only 6,000. This was a quote. The numbers W4 is giving takes for granted the wireman's definition of a day's work, which is the wiring of two electrical devices a day, as based on the informal group norms. Specifically, 6,600 connections is the number of wires that must be connected to complete two electrical devices of the first type he mentions, called the connector. The second electrical device the worker mentions, selectors, requires only 6,000 connections to wire two of them. Thus, this worker's concept of a day's work is the same as the previous worker quoted, which is the wiring of two electrical devices in one work shift. This concept is shared by most, but not all, of the workers in the study. It is interesting to note that this worker prefers to work on connectors. This is true of most of the wiremen, in spite of the fact that connectors have 300 more connections than selectors. The reason generally given for this preference is that selectors are lighter in weight. The researchers did not believe this explanation, because it is only necessary to carry two of the devices to the working area each day. The researchers believe that the real reason the wiremen preferred connectors related to social status within the group. This did not generally relate to money, because the hourly rate for wiring connectors and selectors were essentially the same. That is, according to the researchers, the connector wireman represented the elite. This was a quote. Rothlisberger, F.J. and Dixon, W.J., 1939 and 1967, pages 496. Incidentally, the soldiermen, who worked with the wiremen, were believed to be the lowest status group members by the researchers. When employees started in this type of work, they would start as soldiermen, with a lower rate of pay than the wiremen. Soldiermen might be promoted to a wireman after they were working in the plant for a period of time. W5, I turn out 100% efficiency right along. That means I turn out 6,600 a day. One int is the bogey 6,600 a day? This was a quote. W5, no, that's not the bogey. The bogey is 7,200. I think this was a quote. The following note appeared on the bottom of the page, in the original source. One, in order to have an efficiency of 100%, a wireman would have to wire 7,312 terminals a day. This was a quote. The 7,312 figure is the company's definition of 100% efficiency, which is the bogey. However, this worker's definition of 100% efficiency is 6,600, which is the informal group norm for the proper work output, which is the wiring of two electronic devices. W6 well, the bogey is pretty high. I turn out 6,600 a day right along, and that is pretty good, I think, for the average. And is that the bogey? This was a quote W6 I think it is this was a quote and then you are making 100% efficiency? This was a quote W6 well, I don't know about that. I don't think I am turning out 100%. You see the bogey was 914 an hour for an 8¾ hour day, so I suppose it will be about 6,600 for an 8 hour day. This worker appears to be trying to rationalize his average level of production, which is the group norm of 6,600, or two electrical devices wired in a day. The amount for a 8-hour day would be 8,914 equals 7,312, not 6,600, which the worker incorrectly estimated to be correct for the interviewer. W7 6,000 a day is the rate, I guess there's another rate that's higher than that, but the bosses tell us that 6,000 is a day's work. This is essentially the wiring of two electrical devices, if the worker is wiring selectors, which require 3,000 connections for each device. If he is wiring connectors, which requires 3,300, his work output is slightly below the group norm, of two electrical devices wired in a day. Thus, the quotations from the seven workers clearly indicate a concept of a day's work based on the wiring of two electrical devices. This was verified by the observer, who found that the operators frequently stopped wiring when they had finished their quotas even though it was not official stopping time. This was a quote, wrote Lisberger, F.J. and Dixon, W.J., 1939 and 1967, pages 414. That is, the observer reported that they saw many of the workers stop work after they wired two electrical devices. The concerns about being laid off, because of increases in productivity, was expressed in the interviews, but there were many other concerns also expressed about exceeding the worker's definition of a day's work. The following are quotations from the workers and interviewer. If we exceed our day's work by any appreciable amount, something will happen. The rate might be cut, the rate might be raised, the bogey might be raised, someone might be laid off, or the supervisor might ball out the slow arm. This was a quote. This quotation is a general statement presented in the original source, wrote Lisberger, F.J. and Dixon, W.J., 1939 and 1967, pages 417, as a summation of the attitudes of the workers that were interviewed. W2 after claiming that he turned out more work than anyone else in the group, they his co-workers don't like to have me turn in so much, but I turn it in anyway. This was a quote in another interview. Right now I'm turning out over 7,000 a day, around 7,040. The rest of the fellows kick because I do that. They want me to come down. They want me to come down to around 6,600, but I don't see why I should. If I did, the supervisors would come in and ask me what causes me to drop like that. I've been turning out about that much for the last 6 months now, and I see no reason why I should turn out less. There's no reason why I should turn out more either. This was a quote. This worker is apparently a deviant as far as the group norm of 6,600 connections or the wiring of two electrical devices a day is concerned. However, it appears that he also has a concept of a day's work that is a little greater than the norm. The last sentence indicates that he believes there is no reason to do any more work than he does. W3 No one can turn out the bogey consistently. Well, occasionally some of them do. Now since the layoff started there's been a few fellows down there who have been turning out around 7,300 a day. They've been working like hell. I think it is foolishness to do it because I don't think it will do them any good, and it is likely to do the rest of us a lot of harm. This was a quote in just how do you figure that? This was a quote W3 Well, you see, if they start turning out around 7,300 a day over a period of weeks and if three of them do it, then they can lay one of the men off, because three men working at that speed can do as much as four men working at the present rate. This was a quote int, and you think that is likely to happen? This was a quote W3 Yes, I think it would. At present we are only scheduled for 40 sets ahead. In normal times we were scheduled for over 100. If they find that fewer men can do the work, they're going to lay off more of us. When things pick up they will expect us to do as much as we are now. That means they will raise the bogey on us. You see how it works? This worker has definite fears about the consequences of exceeding the concept of a day's work, of 6,600 connections or two electrical devices wired in a day. The interviewer does not seem to be capable of relating to the worker equals S concerns. He questions the employee equals S concerns by saying, and you think that is likely to happen? This was a quote. There probably is a gap between the working class worker, and the interviewer who is probably middle class and college educated. The realities faced by the unskilled and semi-skilled factory workers are very different from the experiences of the middle class professional or semi-professional. Factory workers do get laid off if management can produce more work with fewer workers. Didn't you say there is no incentive to turn out more work? If all of you did more work, wouldn't you make more money? This was a quote W4 no, we wouldn't. They told us that down there one time. You know, the supervisors came around and told us that very thing, that if we would turn out more work we would make more money, but we can't see it that way. Probably what would happen is that our bogey would be raised, and then we would just be turning out more work for the same money one. I can see that this was a quote. The following footnote appears on the bottom of the page of the original source 1. It should be remembered that raising the bogey could not have this effect unless it resulted in lower output. This was a quote. This note also suggests a misunderstanding between the workers and the optimistic middle class perspective of the researchers. Companies have been known to set prices for work based on the number of units that can be produced by a factory worker in a day. If it is obvious to the management that workers can produce more for the same money, the company might take advantage of the situation. We often see this when new technology is incorporated into a production process. Less workers do more work, and they may get paid less, if operating the machine requires less skill than the older methods. That is, employers do not necessarily pass on the economic gains to factory workers that result from increases in their productivity. Such gains might be passed on to consumers in lower prices, or to executive-level employees, or to the stockholders of the company. Of course, in some cases such gains are passed on to factory workers, especially if there is a union involved. W5 There's another thing. You know the fellows give the fast workers the raspberry all the time. Work hard, try to do your best, and they don't appreciate it at all. They don't seem to figure that they are gaining any by it. It's not only the wiremen, the soldiermen don't like it either, the fellows who loaf along are liked better than anybody else. Some of them take pride in turning out as little work as they can and making the boss think they're turning out a whole lot. They think it's smart. I think a lot of them have the idea that if you work fast the rate will be cut. That would mean that they would have to work faster for the same money. I've never seen a rate cut yet, so I don't know whether it would happen or not. I have heard it has happened in some cases though. This was a quote. This worker appears to be giving a realistic perspective of the experience of being a wireman in the Hawthorne plants. The fast workers are not liked by others because they violate the norm of a day's work. This violation is perceived as a potential threat to the entire group. The workers that are liked the most are the least productive, because their lack of productivity does not threaten anyone. W5 also reports that the least productive workers often try to fool management by making them think that they are producing more than they are. This shows a generalized hostility toward management. W5 is also not sure what would happen if the workers became more productive. This uncertainty, which is based on real risks in certain cases, helps motivate and maintain the restrictive concept of a day's work. W6 Talking about a relative of his who worked in the plant, she gets in here early and gets ahead and makes up a lot of parts so that when the rest of the girls start in, she's already got a whole lot stacked up. In that way she turns out a great deal of work. She's money greedy. That's what's the matter with her, and they shouldn't allow that. All she does is spoil the rate for the rest of the girls. This was a quote. And how does she do that? This was a quote. W6 By turning out so much. When they see her making so much money, they cut the rate. This was a quote. W6 is talking about a relative who is a deviant by the informal standards of the group. He is obviously condemning her by his words. There appears to be very little understanding or acceptance that it is a worker's right to be as productive as he or she wants to be. This is apparent not only from the above comments. It is apparent from most of the statements from the interviews and observations. W7 There's one little guy down there that turns out over 7,000 a day. I think there's a couple of them. And we have to put up with it. This was a quote. Again, a worker is being condemned for simply being productive. However, there is some realization in this comment that it is his right to be productive, because the words appear and we have to put up with it. This was a quote. But the group will not accept it as proper, by their standards. They will even try to punish such workers, which will become apparent in the following paragraphs. The Hawthorne studies also involved observations of the workers, as already stated. These observations reinforced the information obtained in the interviews. This part of the study ran from November 1931 to May 1932 and involved 14 bank wirers. No changes were made in the work environment, that is, there was no experimental manipulation of the work environment. The idea was to observe the usual behavior of the workers. The following paragraphs contain some of the original notes that resulted from the observations. As indicated earlier, the source for these notes are the same as the interview notes. W6 and W4 were kidding each other about working hard. W6 was working very fast. W4 was working faster than usual. W4 to W6, go on, you slave, work. You're enough connections ahead now to take care of Friday. This was a quote. Obs to W4, is W6 going too fast to suit you? This was a quote. W4, he's nothing but a slave. A couple more rows and he'll have 8,000. This was a quote. W6, no, I won't. I haven't got today's workout yet. This was a quote. W4, you should have quit when you finished that set. This was a quote. W6, I'm good for another 6,000 connections. If they'd pay me for it, I'd turn them out. This was a quote. W6 is apparently a fast worker, which is confirmed by the statements in the original source. The kidding and related remarks that W4 is inflicting on W6 most likely have some real hostility connected with it. This type of kidding appears to be a way of partly concealing the true level and seriousness of the hostility. This method of partly concealing hostility is apparently used by the entire group, which will become more apparent in the following paragraphs. A major error becomes apparent in the Hawthorne observations by examining the notes from the observer, which is abbreviated OBS in his notes. The observer was obviously known to the group, and he was communicating with the workers. Obviously, the workers were aware that they were being watched. All of the above can greatly affect behavior and communications amongst the workers. Such obvious observations can totally change the behaviors of the people being observed in some cases. How much it actually affected the behaviors and communications from one worker to another is not known. Since the interviews and the observations of the wiremen and soldermen are fairly consistent, it probably did not affect the interactions of the workers to an extreme degree in this part of the study. However, these observations should not be considered scientific because of the errors or oversights mentioned above. GC2 was taking the output count. W4 to W6, how many are you going to turn in? This was a quote. W6, I've got to turn in 6,800. This was a quote. W4, what's the matter? Are you crazy? You work all week and turn in 6,600 for a full day, and now today you're away an hour and a quarter and you turn in more than you did the other days. This was a quote. W6, I don't care. I'm going to finish these sets tomorrow. This was a quote. W4, you're screwy. This was a quote. W6, all right, I'll turn in 6,400. This was a quote. W4, that's too much. This was a quote. W6, that don't make any difference. I've got to do something with them. This was a quote. W4, well, give them to me. This was a quote. W6 did not answer. W6 is a fast worker, who apparently violates the group norms to some extent, which is limited to the wiring of 2 electrical devices a day. From the observer's notes, it is apparent that W6 missed it over 1 hour of work. In spite of this, he produced more than 6,600 connections. W4 apparently is pressuring W6 to turn in less, on the official records. The above observations, and the text that follows, clearly indicate that the workers simply do not work as hard as they could. This was already determined to be the case from the interviews. W2 to S1, come on, get this set. This was a quote. S1, all right, this was a quote to OBS. I want to introduce you to Lightning W2 and Cyclone W3. When those two get going, it's just like a whirlwind up here. Give W2 a big chow of snuff and he just burns the solder right off the terminals. This was a quote. The most obvious error here is W2 and W3 were introduced by S1 to the observer. In addition, they were introduced as fast workers. This certainly is not an example of scientific observation. As already indicated, the observer should not be seen if the observations are to be considered scientific. Perhaps, an exception to this might be in the case of participant observation, and such observations could only approach scientific levels of perfection if the people involved do not know they are being observed. S1 to OBS. What's a guy going to do if these fellows won't quit work? This was a quote. OBS, that's it, what? This was a quote. S1, keep right on working. This was a quote. OBS, there you are. Now you've got it. This was a quote. S1, W2 has 8,000 and he don't know enough to quit. Well, if he wires 8,000, I must order 8,000. That's it, isn't it? This was a quote. I'm sure this was a quote. W2 does not appear to be concerned about breaking the group norms. Another possibility is the reality, is that S1 and W2 are concerned that the observer is connected to management, which is in fact the case. The workers might be simply concerned that they will eventually be reported, which certainly was not the intention of the Hawthorne studies. Thus, they may be putting up a show for the observer. This is, of course, possible with all of the interviews and observations. Some workers may have felt that it was to their advantage to communicate to management their dissatisfaction with the work environment and the related level of work desired by management. Of course, the above possibility is probably not the case, but the point is that it could be, and the data gathered cannot truly be considered scientific. W8 to W6, why don't you quit work? Let's see, this is your 35th row today. What are you going to do with them all? This was a quote. W6, what do you care? It's to your advantage if I work, isn't it? This was a quote. W8, yeah, but the way you're working you'll get stuck with them. This was a quote. W6, don't worry about that. I'll take care of it. You're getting paid by the sets I turn out. That's all you should worry about. This was a quote. W8, if you don't quit work I'll bing you. This was a quote. W8 struck W6 and finally chased him around the room. Obs a few minutes later, what's the matter, W6, won't he let you work? This was a quote. W6, no. I'm all through though. I've got enough done. This was a quote. He then went over and helped another wireman. W6 is one of the fast workers who often breaks the informal group norms of a day's work. W8 is quite annoyed here by W6's industriousness. W8 gives him a final warning, threatening to bing him, and then carries out the warning. Bing is a controlled form of physical aggression, where one individual strikes another in the upper arm, according to the description in the original source. Binging was used to settle disputes and it had a special utility in controlling the group members to produce no more than a day's work. That is, if someone worked faster or produced more than he or she was supposed to, the individual faced the risk of a bing, a punch in the upper arm by another worker. From the above notes of the interviews and observations, it is apparent that a set of informal norms and values developed amongst the workers, which partly went against the official standards and goals of the company. That is, the Hawthorne studies indicate that the workers often had a hostile attitude toward the company and its standards. It is also clear that the Hawthorne studies gave the first clear evidence of subcultural variation in the workplace. This was a quote. Pepper, G. L., 1995, pages 90. That is, the informal norms, values, beliefs, attitudes and related behaviors of the workers at the Hawthorne plant can be conceptualized in terms of an organizational subculture that is partly in opposition to the main organizational culture. This organizational subculture probably developed partly as a result of the societal subculture, past employment experiences, personality-related factors and financial insecurity that the Hawthorne workers brought to the workplace. These factors combined with the social interactions in the work environment and the development of personal relationships amongst these workers, produced a specific type of organizational subculture. The subculture that developed amongst the factory workers in the Hawthorne plant was basically non-competitive, cooperative, and was more or less intended to be based on the concerns for the workers, as well as the self. Specifically, the concept of the day's work was partly based on a worker not doing more than his share of work, because it was believed that it can put other workers at a disadvantage. A Hawthorne factory worker that does more than a day's work could make a little more money, because of the small bonus paid. Such a person might possibly be advanced to a slightly higher position, and at the very least his or her employment would probably be maintained by the company even in times of job layoffs. However, all of the above would essentially involve competing against the other workers, by trying to produce more than the definition of a day's work, which was prohibited by the norms of the subculture that developed amongst the factory workers in the Hawthorne plant. Most likely the subculture norm that restricted production primarily developed as a result of self-interest. The Hawthorne workers probably felt quite insecure if other workers were competing against them by producing as much as possible. In addition, the workers probably found the restricted production norms that they created to be useful in preventing overwork and the related stress of working to the maximum level. The development of the norm was also clearly related to a belief that by controlling production the workers would get paid more in the long run. In addition, the development of the norm of restricting production to a certain level was also probably related to the fear of being laid off. That is, there was a concern that there simply would not be enough work to go around if the workers produced at a maximum level. This may have been a legitimate concern, because these workers were faced with the possibility of being laid off during the years of the Great Depression. There were in fact some workers that did lose their jobs, which is apparent from some of the comments made in the interviews. I will get back to the concept of organizational subculture and related norms later on in this chapter, because now it is time to resolve the mystery. What caused the strange results of the Hawthorne experiments? From the interviews and observations, it is apparent that the Hawthorne workers did not work to their maximum level under ordinary working conditions. They were restricted by the group norm of a day's work, which limited their productivity significantly. When they were placed in experimental and control groups, the norms from their previous work groups were no longer active, meaningful, or significant. Thus, without the restrictive norms, they produced more. There is an additional factor that could have contributed to the strange results, which is given by most sources as the cause of the strange experimental results. The workers were under close experimental observation by the researchers, which also can be a primary contributor to the increase in productivity. That is, when people are given the special attention associated with being experimental subjects, they may be very cooperative. They may want the experiment to work. They might invest much effort in doing what they believe the experimenter wants, which can result in very significant increases in performance. This concept is now called the Hawthorne effect, and it is often considered in most human behavior experiments. That is, experimenters in psychology, social psychology, sociology, organizational behavior, and related fields try to avoid the Hawthorne effect, because it can ruin an experiment by giving inflated performance-related results. However, after carefully examining the notes that resulted from the Hawthorne interviews and observations, I do not believe that the Hawthorne effect was the primary cause of the increase in productivity in the Hawthorne experiments. Actually, it was simply the breakdown of the restrictive norms that existed in the regular work groups. This becomes obvious if we keep in mind that the interviews and observations simply indicate that the workers were deliberately producing at a lower level than they could. In addition, some workers interfered with the work of other workers. This interference even involved physical aggression. Incidentally, it is interesting to note that the special attention associated with the interviews and observations did not result in a detectable increase in production. That is, the interviews and observations did not cause a noticeable Hawthorne effect. Thus, it is perhaps questionable that the observations in the experimental and control groups caused a significantly large Hawthorne effect. Thus, the evidence is that the restrictive production norms broke down in the experimental and control groups. However, this can be looked at from a slightly different perspective. That is, one can make a moderately good counter-argument to the above, by saying that the breakdown of the norms was the result of the special attention that the workers received in the experimental and control groups, and this is one of many possible ways that the Hawthorne effect can manifest. However, the important point is to realize that the restrictive production norms were not functioning in the groups the experimenters set up, which most likely resulted in the mysterious increases in production. Thus, the mystery is solved, and now we can examine what else we can learn from the Hawthorne studies. What were the overall conclusions of the Hawthorne researches? The conclusions were quite complex, and appear not to have been primarily focused on solving the mystery that originally stimulated their interest, but they did believe that the mysterious experimental results were caused by the methods of observation used in the experimental procedures. That is, by examining the literature that these researchers wrote, it is apparent that their focus was expanded from simply solving a mysterious research result to a more substantial set of goals, which involve the development of general information and methods for management. The literature I am referring to in the above sentence is the following book. This culminated in a 615-page book on the Hawthorne studies, written by two of the researchers Fritz Rothlisberger and William Dixon, called Management and the Worker. Thus, their basic conclusions are elaborate, but they have been summarized in many publications and textbooks. An especially good summary appears in Saul, Frank E. and Knight, Patrick K. 1995 Industrial/Organizational Psychology Science and Practice 2nd Edition, which is as follows. 1. An individual's work behaviors are rarely consequences of simple cause and effect relationships but are more often determined by complex sets of multiple factors. This was a quote. This basic idea actually applies to almost all human behavior phenomena and studies. Human beings are complex entities and cannot be understood and studied in the same manner as the hard scientist studies the simple entities and principles that relate to the physical universe. For example, all hydrogen atoms of a specific isotope behave in exactly the same way, because they are identical. Human beings are never identical, and thus can behave in ways that are totally unique to the individual or group. Thus, a human behavior-related theory or methodology may work with one group of individuals, under a specific set of circumstances, but it may not work with a different group of individuals even if the circumstances are the same. This becomes obvious if one thinks of the many different cultures, subcultures, and variations in personality. These factors affect perception, responses, and behavior, which can make a theory or method work with one group of individuals and not with another group. 2. Groups of workers develop their own norms or expectations of group members' behaviors that interact with each individual worker's personal needs and the demands of the work setting. This was a quote, "The process of developing norms, expectations of group members, etc., as seen in the Hawthorne work groups, is essentially the process of developing a subculture within an organization. The subculture that the worker is in interacts with his or her psychological makeup. In addition, the psychology of the individual workers making up a group will be a primary factor in determining the nature of the subculture that develops." 3. Job-related symbols of prestige and power influence the social structures of these work groups. This was a quote, "This is essentially a general property of most groups and societies, and the exact natures of the symbols of prestige and power that influence social structure are generally determined or influenced by culture and subculture. The culture of an organization and or the subculture that develops in work groups can determine or influence the nature of the symbols of prestige and power." 4. An individual's unique needs and satisfactions can be understood only in the context of her personal life. This was a quote, "This point applies to human beings in general. Factors that help with the understanding of a person's needs and satisfactions include their culture, subculture, financial circumstances, family structure, sex, age, physical health, personal interests, goals, and individual psychological makeup." 5. Workers' almost reflexive resistance to changes can be reduced by acknowledging their feelings and including them in the decision-making process. This was a quote, "This is likely to be quite correct in most, but certainly not all situations. If the decisions are perceived by the worker as being unfavorable, the worker is not likely to reduce his or her resistance. However, generally human beings do not like being treated like inanimate objects. They like to feel that they have some control over their circumstances, and involving them in the decision-making process can have a favorable effect." 6. The workplace is a social system, not merely a system for producing goods or services. This was a quote, "A work environment can be thought of as a society within a society. The society, or social system, that exists in the work environment essentially has its own culture and subcultures, just as a larger society does." The 6 ideas discussed above all relate to the unique qualities of human beings. Thus, it should not be surprising that the Hawthorne studies and the conclusions of the Harvard researchers contributed to the development of the human relations school. This perspective focuses on the needs of the worker as an individual within the organization that he or she works in. That is, this view of organizational behavior is based on the assumption that the motivations and needs of the employees interact with the official structure, objectives, and methods of the organization. And the idea is that the above factors and the way they interact will determine how the organization actually functions. This human relations view resulted in a higher level of sensitivity to the needs of the workers. Thus, the Hawthorne studies had a positive impact on human needs in relation to employment and advocated better relationships between management and employees. I believe it is fortunate that the data from the Hawthorne studies were interpreted in such a way to produce a result that was beneficial to the workers. The information obtained from the studies could have been interpreted in a way that is very different from the above. A careful examination of the interviews and observations revealed that many workers were hostile to management, were working at a slower rate than was justified, were interfering with the work of other workers by inflicting unjustified verbal and physical punishment if they produced more than the group's definition of a day's work. The reaction to these results could have been to monitor the workers closely, greatly increase discipline, fire workers that are not working at the desired production standards set by management, and to fire workers that verbally or physically abused other workers for any reason. That is, the data from the Hawthorne studies could have been interpreted in such a way as to advocate a get-tough policy toward workers. It should be kept in mind that the Hawthorne studies and conclusions are not an example of a truly scientific investigation. The deviations from scientific precision partly relate to the fact that workers often knew they were being observed. This was the case under both experimental conditions and under general observations that were not experimentally manipulated. In some of the observers' notes from the Hawthorne studies, it is clear that the observer is talking to the workers, which can greatly affect the behavior of the workers as well as their production rate. In addition, the conclusions of the Harvard researchers are highly admirable, quite useful in many management situations, but they are more of a philosophical nature than an example of science. My criticisms and somewhat different interpretation of the Hawthorne studies and resulting data are not unique. There are many such criticisms. The following is a quotation from Saul, Frank E. and Knight, Patrick A. 1995 Industrial/Organizational Psychology Science and Practice 2nd ed. Page 16. "A half century of debate has confirmed that the Hawthorne studies do not represent perfect field research." Yorks and Whitsitt, 1985. For example, statistical reanalysis of the data suggested that more than 90% of the improvements in the Hawthorne employees' performance could be explained by such extraneous factors as improved raw materials, increased supervisory discipline, and workers' anxiety about being laid off. Frank and Call, 1978. This was a quote. My critical comments of the Hawthorne studies are not a criticism of the efforts of the Harvard researchers, because they were dealing with human beings in a very complicated manufacturing facility, which employed approximately 29,000 workers. And sometimes, but certainly not always, when dealing with practical problems that involve human beings, a philosophical evaluation and conclusion are of more value than a truly scientific study. That is, when we are dealing with inanimate entities, it is easy to be scientific, whether or not the study is for practical or theoretical purposes. If a study suggests that the most efficient solution to a manufacturing problem is to destroy the old machinery and sell it for scrap metal, and purchase new equipment, there is no ethical problem. However, a scientific study that suggests something similar in relation to human beings is totally unacceptable and unthinkable, even if we are convinced that it would result in an increase in production. Even firing people, or pushing them to work to the point of significant physiological and psychological stress, poses a serious ethical problem, even if such actions lead to improved productivity. The people that employ and manage workers are also human beings with the capacity for empathy, which fortunately might rule out the use of certain methods of increasing productivity. Thus, philosophy and ethics are important in developing methods and ideas about human behavior that may be applied in practical ways. Hence, when evaluating the imperfections of the Hawthorne studies and related conclusions, it is necessary to keep the above in mind. That is, the researchers probably were quite sensitive and aware that they were dealing with human beings, which may have influenced their conclusions toward a humanistic perspective, as opposed to another view, such as a get-tough policy toward the workers. There are many other ideas that can be developed by evaluating the problems and information from the Hawthorne studies. This is done in the following paragraphs, starting with some additional thoughts about organizational subcultures. The subculture that developed in the Hawthorne plant is probably not unique to that plant. Organizational subcultures that are more or less similar, involving restrictive productivity norms based on the worker's definition of a day's work, probably developed under manufacturing conditions that are roughly similar to the Hawthorne plant. Specifically, where the rate of production is not controlled by a conveyor belt of an assembly line or any other automatic mechanism, where the workers can work at their own pace, where the workers can see the rate that other workers are working at, where the workers can communicate with each other and form relationships with each other. If the above conditions exist and there are poor employee management relationships, the chances of an adverse subculture developing are probably greatly increased. Thus, a question that arises is, what does a manager do with such a situation? Answers are suggested in the four items on the above list. If the rate of production can be controlled by an electronic mechanism, such as an assembly line conveyor belt, the problem might be solved. If the workers cannot see each other's rate of production, the problem might also be prevented or solved. If workers doing a specific type of work are separated in various sections of the plant, the problem might also be prevented or solved. A good employee management relations program might also reduce the chances of the development of an adverse subculture developing amongst the workers. The Hawthorne researchers would advocate this last item, which is obvious from the literature they wrote. Note the word might was used in the above paragraph, because there is no certainty that the methods mentioned would work under all circumstances, but they probably would work under some conditions. In general, there is a high probability that organizational subcultures will develop amongst workers that interact on a regular basis as a result of the work environment. The goal of management should be to try to make every effort to see that such subcultures are friendly to management and its goals. A major cause of the problems of productivity that were seen in the Hawthorne plant was probably partly the result of a poor management-employee relations effort. Specifically, showing a genuine sensitivity to the needs and emotional feelings of workers can probably reduce the chances of the development of an organizational subculture that is hostile toward management and its goals. There is a general tendency for hostile subcultures to develop when there is any type of adverse or unpleasant control imposed on a less powerful group, such as with the factory workers in the Hawthorne plant. However, this tendency is not limited to factory workers, or even to the work environment. It is a general tendency that might manifest under many types of organizational or group structures. This will become apparent if you think about the following examples where hostile subcultures can develop. Any type of work group. Some student groups. teenagers and their subculture. In poor communities where hostile gangs of young people may form. In state and federal prisons. In prisoner of war facilities. Thus, the point is that the development of hostile subcultures is a general tendency that happens when more powerful cultural forces impose controls that are perceived as hostile or significantly unpleasant on a less powerful group. Thus, what was seen in the Hawthorne studies in this regard is certainly not limited to the environment that existed in the Hawthorne production facility. A general solution to this problem is to make all concerned realize the necessity of the controls, and present such controls in ways that are not likely to be perceived as hostile and/or threatening to the interests of the less powerful group members. The above is easier said than done. In some situations, controls and demands by management may truly be against the interests of some of the workers. If, for example, there are efforts to increase the productivity of the workers, with the aim of reducing the number of employees, the goal is clearly against the interests of the people that will lose their jobs. Another general idea suggested by the Hawthorne studies is the informal concept of a day's work held by the employees. This concept can develop as a result of an organizational subculture as already indicated, but it can also develop independently of any organizational subculture, within the minds of the workers. The concept of a day's work is present in many occupations, and is certainly not limited to the circumstances of the Hawthorne plant during the studies. Workers often have an idea of what a fair, or appropriate, day's work is. If they reach this level before their work shift is completed, they might stop working, pretend to be working, or get involved in conversations or other non-work-related activities. Some workers may pace their work at a moderately slow rate so they do not have any idle time to waste, until they are permitted to leave the workplace. When workers are permitted to leave based on their own discretion, they may try to finish what they believe is an appropriate amount of work for a day, and then they might leave the workplace. In such cases, they might rush through the work with the aim of completing it in the shortest possible time, so they can leave as early as possible. Under certain circumstances, the worker's definition of a day's work will be more or less based on the smallest amount of work that the employee believes that he or she can get away with. In such situations, if the employee finds that he or she can work at 90% of officially defined work output for a day, he or she might then try to lower the level to 80%. If 80% is accepted, he or she might try to lower it to 70%. This process of lowering the work output might continue until the employee finds the lowest level of work output he or she can get away with. The employee might be doing this in a way that is more or less inadvertent. People often do not like their jobs and it takes willpower to do their work. If the employee equals S willpower is not helped along with appropriate standards and guidance from management, the result might be a lower work output. Thus, appropriate observation and guidance can probably reduce the significance of such a problem. Note the word might was used in the above paragraph because all workers are certainly not inclined to behave as described. However, the point is that there are some employees that will behave as described under certain conditions. Thus, the informal concept of a day's work as defined by the workers can be a problem for management. Generally, management might want to obtain as much work as possible from each worker. This may not always be a functional approach, as will be discussed a little later on in this text. A more functional approach might simply be to set the pay scale based on the worker's concept of a day's work. If a worker does more, he or she should get paid accordingly. The above is not the same as offering a small bonus for doing more than the informally defined concept of a day's work, because when such bonuses are offered, the worker usually does not get paid a full additional day's pay if he or she accomplishes an extra day's work over a period of time. From the worker's point of view, he might feel that he is getting gypped, or he might simply feel that the effort is not worth the small compensation that is paid by the employer for doing the extra work. Keep in mind that such bonuses did not work when they were tried in the Hawthorne studies. Of course, under some conditions such bonuses might work to increase production. Another method of dealing with the problem of the worker's concept of a day's work is not to place workers doing the identical job in groups, which was already mentioned as a possible way of preventing the development of a hostile subculture that restricts production. Of course, in many cases this is simply not a feasible solution, because many other problems can result, such as difficulties with supervising the workers, problems with transferring the needed supplies to the workers, problems instructing the workers, psychological problems of working alone, etc. Another highly useful way of reducing the problem of low productivity, as a result of the worker's definition of a day's work, is to select employees with personalities that facilitate high levels of production. This was even apparent in the Hawthorne studies. The wiremen designated W-2 and W-6 in the observations produce more than the workers' definition of a day's work, in spite of the punishments they would receive from the other workers. Thus, individuals with certain types of personalities, under certain conditions will be significantly more productive than other employees. Of course, this does not indicate anything about such personality types, or how to select such individuals. In general, the best way to select such workers is probably by trial and error. Perhaps careful interviewing can also be of some help in this selection process. Potential employees that show no concern about high workloads in the interviews are probably more favorable than those who show a concern about workload. Thus, there are a number of ways of avoiding the problem of the worker's restrictive definition of a day's work. However, it should be kept in mind that a worker's concept of a day's work might be quite functional for all concerned in some cases, even though it might make the worker less productive. It might serve the purpose of preventing excessive emotional and physiological stress on the worker. Such stress can cause both physical and mental disorders, as well as errors in production, accidents, and high employee turnover. The above can be quite expensive. Sick leave can increase the medically related costs for a company. An error in production can ruin an expensive device that is being manufactured. For example, one wire connected to the wrong terminal in an electrical device can make it useless. Accidents can cost the company money in compensation, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Employee turnover can cost the company money for finding new workers and training them. Thus, the gains made by pushing workers beyond their concept of a day's work might be outweighed by the resulting financial losses and related risks to the well-being of the workers, in some cases. In the following five paragraphs, I will cover some important ideas about measuring worker performance, which was less apparent in the period when the Hawthorne studies were carried out. The utility of these ideas become apparent if the data from the Hawthorne experiments are examined. To truly obtain accurate studies, it is necessary to measure the workers' performance in their usual work environment under the usual working conditions that exist in that environment, and not to inform the workers that they are being experimentally evaluated. There are other considerations that are discussed below. When people are exposed to new situations, such as increased illumination, new equipment, new work methods, etc., there is very likely to be an initial change in productivity, which can be greater or less than the previous level of productivity. This initial change may or may not indicate a long-term change in productivity. In general, there can be many unknown components as well as known factors that can temporarily increase production in certain cases. This result can be called a positive placebo effect. A temporary reduction in productivity, as a result of some change in the production facility, can be called a negative placebo effect. That is, there can be many unknown components as well as known factors that can initially interfere with production when changes are made. The temporary increase or decrease in production as a result of a change can often be predicted if enough factors are known. This can even be estimated on a graph in terms of the change in production. Such graphical representations might be important when dealing with temporary reductions in productivity as a result of introducing new equipment. Some examples will clarify the above ideas. If the decorations and illumination of a factory are increased, one possible outcome is an increase in production due to the enthusiasm associated with the more attractive environment. This enthusiasm may wear off in a few weeks, resulting in a level of production that was no greater than previous levels. Another example, which is probably much more common, is the effect of introducing new equipment or methods, which can in some cases result in an initial reduction in productivity, even if the new technology has been proven useful in other facilities. That is, the workers may not know how to use the new equipment or utilize the new methods at an efficient level. In addition, new equipment or methods often have many imperfections in them, which must be corrected. The workers can initially have concerns and adverse emotional responses to the new technology, which can interfere with production. Thus, evaluations can initially indicate a very significant reduction in productivity in some cases, which can take weeks to overcome. That is, as the workers develop the knowledge and experience with the new equipment or methods, productivity may increase. If the new equipment or methods are truly of value, the increase in production will reach a level that is greater than the level of production that was achieved before the new technology was applied. Of course, this may not happen in all cases. Sometimes new technology simply does not work under a specific set of circumstances as well as older methods. However, generally as the workers become more experienced with the new technology, the productivity exceeds all previous levels. Another important idea that relates to the evaluation of people and their productivity is called the Hawthorne effect, which was already discussed earlier in this paper. This concept is, of course, obviously named after the Hawthorne studies. When people are put under evaluative observation and given special attention, their productivity may increase as a result, which can interfere with an accurate scientific evaluation. This phenomena, as already discussed, is believed to have accounted for the mysterious results of the Hawthorne experiments. However, the opposite effect is also possible. That is, when people are put under evaluative observation and given special attention, their productivity may decrease as a result, under certain conditions, which can interfere with the evaluation. That is, a negative Hawthorne effect is also possible, in some cases. The primary point of the above paragraphs is whatever the initial evaluation indicates in relation to any type of change S, it should not be considered as an indication of the long-term evaluation. That is, the short-term evaluation can indicate one result and the long-term evaluation can indicate an entirely different result. Of course, there are situations when the short-term evaluation and long-term evaluation are the same. Note the above paragraph represents a general principle of evaluating, which applies to any type of evaluation, and it is not limited to the work environment. Some examples will clarify this general principle of evaluation. Most of us have had experiences with evaluating electronic equipment, medication, and people in everyday life. We often find that electronic equipment, such as personal computers, initially reduce our efficiency until we learn how to use it with a reasonably high level of skill. Those who took their first experiences with the computer too seriously probably gave up before they developed the needed skills to use the computer at a highly productive level. That is, such individuals evaluated their abilities and/or the usefulness of the computer in the earliest stages of the learning process, and concluded that they lacked the abilities needed to master the use of computers or decided that computers are not useful devices for the type of work they are doing. This type of erroneous evaluation, based on the early stages of learning, is common in many situations, and it leads to unjustified discouragement. Another example is seen with the use of medication. Often, when medication is first used, it either produces unpleasant side effects, or it appears to be highly effective. Such initial results can change with time, which certainly suggests that the initial evaluation would not be valid. This evaluative principle also applies to people. When we meet people, we may find that we initially like them or do not like them. This evaluation can often change, as we get to know the individuals. There are many cases where people meet a mate, marry the person based on an early positive evaluation, and eventually get to know them at the deepest level after they are married, which can, in some cases, result in a negative evaluation and divorce. In such cases, the evaluator made a positive evaluation in the early stages of the relationship without having enough information, which resulted in an erroneous assessment. There are some people that evaluate a potential mate in a somewhat different but also dysfunctional way. They evaluate a potential mate in one date in a negative way. Such negative evaluations can result from experiencing the awkwardness of getting to know a person, which often includes anxiety and saying the wrong things. Individuals that make such quick evaluations might have difficulty finding a mate. Every person they date may be evaluated on superficial minor blunders and other minor imperfections. Thus, the point is whether you are dealing with an evaluation in the work environment or an evaluation in everyday life, the best strategy in most cases is not to take the initial evaluation too seriously. The initial evaluation is often erroneous, and a longer-term assessment is likely to be more accurate. End of note. In conclusion, there is a huge amount of information that can be learned and derived from the data from the Hawthorne studies, in spite of the fact that these studies were completed over 60 years ago. I tried to focus on the most interesting and useful ideas that can be obtained from these studies in this paper. The following list of questions summarizes some of the ideas presented in this paper. These ideas should be considered when dealing with the work environment and related problems. If the Hawthorne researchers had such a list and the related information, they could have obtained the answers to their mysteries much sooner than they did. What is the nature of the organizational culture and how does it impact on the employees? What is the nature of the organizational subculture of the workers? That is, do the workers have any unofficial norms, values, beliefs, customs, status symbols, ways of thinking, ways of interacting, etc., which relate to the work environment? Is the subculture hostile toward the main organizational culture? That is, do the workers have any unofficial norms, values, beliefs, customs, status symbols, ways of thinking, attitudes, ways of interacting that goes against the interests of the organization, such as by restricting production? Which workers have more status and which workers have less status within the work group? Why do some workers in the group have more status than others? Do the workers have any restrictive norms that limit production? What is the worker's definition of a reasonable day's work? Are the employees producing at a reasonably high level of efficiency? Would it be functional to try to increase the level of productivity of the workers, or would such efforts cause significant problems? What are the group dynamics that exist, and what are the group dynamics that are likely to develop over a period of time in the work group S? Can the group S be reorganized into a non-group or into a different group configuration that will be more productive? Are the workers discontented with the work environment and/or the tasks they must perform? Is there any discontent in the organization, and if there is, what is the nature of the discontent, and how can it be reduced or eliminated?